This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
I'm Hemant Mehta.
This is Jessica Blumke.
And you're listening to the podcast for FriendlyAtheist.com. Jessica recently attended the Amazing Meeting, a skeptics conference in Las Vegas, where she had the chance to talk to a number of amazing people.
For this episode, I was joined by Skeptics Guide to the Universe host and neuroscientist Stephen Novella and magician John Armstrong. We spoke about this year's TAM theme of skepticism in the brain, how faulty your memories are, and how the placebo effect is not what you may think. Welcome to the podcast for FriendlyAtheist.com. This is Jessica Blumke. I'm coming to you from TAM 2014, and today I am joined by...
Hi, this is Stephen Novella from the Skeptics Guide to the Universe.
And I'm John Armstrong from my mother, I guess.
Well, John is a magician.
I am a magician.
He has credentials.
Yeah.
He won an award once.
I did win an award once.
Yep. And that's all we'll say about that.
Yeah, I was close magician of the year.
So anyway, we're here at TAM, and it's all about skepticism in the brain. Why it makes that a compelling subject matter for an entire conference to revolve around just the physics of, you know, the physicality of the brain.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost redundant in my opinion. You know, skepticism, critical thinking. For me, I'm obviously a neuroscientist, mm-hmm. but it's all about how our brains work. It's understanding, you know, cognition, how we think about things, why we believe things. Ultimately, it's all about how the brain functions. Mm-hmm. So it's a natural combination. Obviously, you know, you can focus specifically on neuroscientific topics at the conference.
Right.
You know, hence the theme. But it is every year it's skepticism in the brain to some extent because it's part and parcel of critical thinking.
That would make a lot of sense. I was curious, like the things that were amazing to me were the false memory stuff that the woman was speaking about
yesterday.
It was incredible to me because I've never really thought about that as far as how the mind works in that way in which you can just totally completely believe that something has happened when it's obviously not happened.
Yeah. So that's in my opinion one realization that, like, somebody who is a skeptical, critical thinker has, to some extent, wrapped their head around, but, like, the average person may not.
Right.
And if I try to, like, have people walk away with this one thing, understanding one thing, is that, you know, everything you think, feel, believe, remember, perceive is a constructed fiction of your brain. Everything.
Right.
And, you know, it could break down in multiple different ways. And just so you bring up the notion of false memory. Every memory is kind of a false memory in that it's not any kind of direct recording of what actually happened. Your brain constructed that memory,
right?
And multiple things went into that. And then every time you remember it, it reconstructs the memory and it updates the memory with what you've learned since then and what you've come to believe since then. And so it's an endless process of just reconstructing this narrative fiction that has only an indirect relationship to something that actually happened in the past.
Right.
So. But we don't. It's seamless to us. We don't perceive that. To us, it's just a memory, and every memory is just a memory. And our confidence doesn't even predict anything about the accuracy of those memories. But if you could really wrap your head around that, that takes care of a lot of nonsense, in my opinion.
Right. You know, it's funny. It's like because I am far from a neuroscientist. I do card tricks. you know, for a living, and so
you've read, of course, the Neuroscience of Magic.
Yeah, you know? I have read that book, and I'm actually...
Sleight of Mind,
quite skeptical of that book, to be completely honest. As a magician, I look at that and go, I don't think they actually had it right. Like, mm-hmm. in a lot of ways, there's not... Like, the way that they're trying to say that magic works on the brain, I don't think that's how it works at all. In fact, I think their studies were far from completely mm-hmm. scientific or controlled, especially when it came to the one thing where they showed Matt King doing this coin vanish, and that the mind would follow it no matter what. It's not true. Just he just does that move just so much better than anybody else that if they would have found someone who did it just like adequately, I don't think they would have gotten the exact same results.
Yeah, that's interesting. So yeah, maybe you might be better off studying mediocre magicians than the best magicians.
Yeah,
and trying to deconstruct neurologically what's happening,
well, especially where the eye's going and the mind's going and how that actually plays. So I read that book and I'm actually I find the whole thing not very believable at all, honestly. But as a non neuroscientist, well, the thing I kind of came from this conference, what I've learned so far, which I think is kind of cool, is that it seems like, I mean, when it comes to memory at least, you're just remembering the last time you remembered that thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just like you're just kind of constantly building on that same, it's almost like a game of telephone in your own head.
It's an internal game of telephone,
yeah,
exactly.
And that's amazing to me.
Right, and there's just multiple, it's even worse than that, because there's all sorts of ways in which it can get contaminated. You know, like if I tell you something, and you would just incorporate that into your memory and just becomes part of your memory. Or, you know, people could actually shift a memory of something happening to somebody else and remember it as if it happened to them.
Right.
And you can actually change the subject of your memory. Or you can fuse two memories entirely. It's like you mix half of the previous game of telephone with your current, you know, game of telephone. Just fuse them together and create something entirely new, or just shift the details around. But another way to look at it, again, at sort of the bottom line notions I like people to walk away with. One is that what you remember, think, believe is a narrative. It's a story that you tell yourself.
Right.
And that story is actually more important than any of the details that go into the story. The details are malleable. Your brain will happily shift them around just to make sure that the narrative is nice, one little nice seamless narrative. When you want to know what's actually true, what's actually happened, you have to kind of deconstruct that, you know, that narrative. And you also need to go to objective sources of information, external objective sources. That's science, right? That's
right,
why we have science. But otherwise, we're the slave to whatever narrative we're telling ourselves that day.
That's fact.
But do people, I'm sure, have a hard time believing that? Like, you have to think you can trust your own brain.
Yeah.
And do you find people struggle, or they don't believe you? Like, no, I remember things fine.
Yeah, I think they compartmentalize. Mm-hmm. I mean, so like if you show people an optical illusion that completely blows their mind, they're like, whoa, you know, that totally blew my mind. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, that's everything. Everything is an illusion. But they just have a hard time extrapolating to like their everyday life.
Yeah.
And so that's the leap you got to make them. So sometimes I tell people, all right, think of your fondest childhood memory. It's almost certainly entirely wrong. In a fiction, and they just they can intellectually maybe understand that, but they don't internalize that lesson and like really live it. That's it's not like a totally black or white thing. That's a lifelong quest to try to really internalize those lessons and really understand, you know, how fallible our minds are in all the various ways, and what you have to do, the process you have to go through to actually know something somewhat reliably.
Yeah. I don't know, I feel like I kind of have an understanding of like how the mechanics of a sleight of hand trick work,
really?
But I still see it.
Really?
I have a basic understanding of things.
Sure. The basic understanding is something he did there, thing.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, is that not it?
It's a little more complicated.
It's a trick.
It is a trick.
Pretty sure it's a trick.
It's very much a trick. I'm very open about that. Like, when I perform, that's how I perform. I'm not like, I don't disclaim it or anything. But I mean, I'm very open about the fact that this is just sleight of hand, it's like live special effects.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. I'm very open about that. But what were you trying to say when I interrupted you so rudely?
Who knows? Nobody knows for sure what I was trying to say.
Yeah.
Even if I like objectively probably know how you did it, I still see the thing disappear, and I'm still blown away by it. What is it about, like, I know what I'm supposed to be looking for, but I still, I guess you're just that good, huh?
I don't know, and it's kind of funny. It's like, I feel like, after what you just said, that maybe I've lived my entire life and got credit for a bunch of stuff that doesn't really, it's not me. Mm. Like you're just saying, like, everything is that. You know, here's a magic trick, boom, that blew your mind. Now, everything is maybe I'm a fraud. Like, the whole thing, like,
that's actually why I brought you here today.
Exactly. This is an intervention. You need to stop. But, like, that's amazing to me. Like, I never even thought about the idea that, you know, that everything... that, you know, yes, you're constantly fooling yourself over and over again all the time.
Yeah.
And I'm just basically, what I do is just one of the catalysts towards that.
Right. You know? You're just exploiting some of the foibles of how you're a three-dimensional optical illusion in a way.
Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. So the other point that I was going to make now that I forgot was, so the brain, there's recent neuropsychological tests that demonstrate this, that our brains evolved to prioritize this seamless narrative. And that what that means is it takes all this disparate information, multiple sensory streams, and our internal model of reality, and it compares it all, and then it will freely make any adjustments necessary to make it all seamless. The seamlessness is important to our brain. The details are not. So I think a lot of magic may derive from that, is that you're creating this scenario, and the brain is going to make it sort of all flow together, and if it has to change details to make it seem to flow together, that's fine for your brain's processing, and you're exploiting the changing of those details.
Right.
So that at the end you have this narrative that you sort of forced the construction of this fake narrative that serves your entertainment purposes, and that's our everyday life. That's all of life is a magic trick in a way.
Yeah, I've spent like a lot of time learning how to not only fool in the moment, but then to construct things so that when later on, when they're remembering it, they remember it completely differently.
Yeah,
even though I might have
touched something. You construct false memories.
Yeah, tons of false memory stuff that I put into what's going on. I've always enjoyed that in a weird sort of manipulative way. I guess, is that the same, when you're saying about our minds instructing, to enforce for the narrative, that everything, is it almost the same way how our eyes look at things, because seeing things in different, but we just kind of blend it together, it's that
exactly.
weird, and it, is that on the same level as that, or is that happening because of that, or is that
it's all part of the same thing,
parallel?
Yeah, okay. So if you look, the visual system, that's actually... You know, optical illusions and these effects that I'm talking about as it applies to vision, that's just the easiest thing to conceptualize. So like for optical illusions, your brain constructs an image that's meaningful to you. It emphasizes things that are important to you. It de-emphasizes things that are irrelevant. It's making those choices in real time all the time.
Right.
And then you can use an optical illusion just exploiting that to create a funny effect. But that's just an analogy. That's true for vision in an obvious way, but it's true for everything else as well. Everything else that you think, remember, feel, all your other sensory streams, you know, not just vision. It's just easiest to demonstrate with vision. So, if, like, for example, with vision, you only really have clear vision for a very small area right in your fovea, right in your focus. Everything else is blurry, but you don't perceive that you're constantly seeing blurry vision because your brain stitches it all together so it seems right. Also, like when you move your eyes, your brain will sort of edit out the jump, and those are just the most obvious things. It also edits out the blind spot, and it also will change what you think you see so that things are smooth and not jumpy. And so it actually like de-emphasizes certain details, or it averages out details over time as well.
Right.
So that was a recent study that showed that. So that averaging out is probably to keep the world from seeming jumpy and changing and all everything. So this seamlessness seems to have the highest priority for our brain's construction of our experience of reality. And that's where all the illusions and all of the things come into play.
Yeah, it must.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's mind-blowing to me.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
How are memories or forming memories affected by your emotional state? Like if you are in a heightened emotional state and angry or scared or whatever, does that make your memory better or worse?
It depends.
Okay.
So generally speaking, highly emotionally charged situations can put you in a heightened sense of alertness. So then you start paying attention, and they can create more vivid memories. But at the same time, they could distract you from things. Right. So. So the short answer is it depends.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like hypnosis. No, not like stage hypnosis. I don't know if you do that as part of your act.
No.
But psychologists actually, there's a sort of a working definition of hypnosis. and what that psychologists are talking about when they're doing certain experiments. But actually, hypnosis is a state of heightened alertness. It's not a trance. It's the exact opposite. You're actually much more alert and attentive in a hypnotic state. The idea is that in that state, it's what the hypnotist is manipulating is what you're attending to. So if you're highly focused, then it's easy to slip things past the goalpost, in other words. So, for example, like you could have your attention diffusely focused on a bunch of different things. Like, I'm going to pay attention to anything weird happening in my environment around me. Mm-hmm. Or you could intensely focus on one thing. But if you do that, you're going to miss everything happening around you. So, and there's everything in between. So in a hypnotic state, you end up focusing, you narrow down your focus so that you could slip things past that you don't notice. But your brain still got that information. Uh-huh. So that's the post-hypnotic suggestion idea. And you know, there's actually psychological studies that support that something like that's happening. But it's just all exploiting the vagaries of how we pay attention. Because mm-hmm. that's another neurological phenomenon that is... It's a trade-off, and it's flawed. You know, you have to attend to some things and not others, and that changes from moment to moment. And actually, your brain is spending a lot of energy calculating what you should pay attention to. You know, that's actually a highly demanding thing that your brain does.
So hypnosis is a real...
It's a thing.
It's a real thing.
Yeah. But don't think...
I have a hard time... See, I always had a hard time with that, mostly because of stage hypnosis.
The stage hypnosis is totally different, and it's just...
And that's just power suggestion?
It's social pressure. People just go...
Compliance. Exactly.
People do what they think they're supposed to do.
But do people really sincere... Like, I did a stage... I got hypnotized one time, and I was like, this is stupid. I'm just like, no, that's... They want me to pat my head, so I'm going to. But I never, for a moment, thought I was actually hypnotized. But do people think they were... Or are they all, like, knowingly going along with...
Well, how do you know?
How do you know?
I could tell you that what they say they think, but I don't know what they actually think.
Yeah, and then there's different levels. And you really question them afterwards. They would, mm-hmm. Some of them would say, yeah, I know, I was just playing along.
Yeah.
Or, I don't know, I felt like I should just do it.
Yeah.
And then that right there, I felt like I should do it. Oh, you were hypnotized.
Yeah.
You know? Right. And so it's pretty much, if you think about it, I just said the same thing twice.
Then I wonder what they'll say a year later. Their memory of it may morph into, I had no control over what I was doing. Who knows? I mean, so that just adds to the legend, you know?
Yeah.
So you're manipulating the memory of what happened as well as the experience of what happened.
So hypnosis for the term, I want to quit smoking.
Yeah. And doesn't work.
It doesn't work.
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that answers my question.
Yeah. So there's that, now you're getting to a separate area, which is the clinical applications of hypnosis, where that's there's a separate literature. So there's psychologists use it just to try to understand things like attention.
Uh-huh.
Entertainers might use it on the stage, but you could also then ask, well, can we use it for specific clinical outcomes?
Mm-hmm.
Things like long-term change of behavior, it's not really very effective. It's actually pretty good for things like pain, because pain is all about attention.
Right.
And so that the hypnosis is all about attention. So if you could divert your attention from your pain, mm-hmm. it helps, you know. So that's where it's useful, because things that directly derive from attention.
Right. And that is a good segue to, you were on a panel the other day and you were talking about the placebo effect. And I thought that was really interesting, because clearly I did not know what placebo effect was.
Nobody does. That's okay. Don't worry about it.
That's okay. Can you kind of give a breakdown about how very wrong I was? Not me personally, but...
Well, there are multiple placebo effects,
uh-huh.
meaning anything that makes you think like you had a positive response to a treatment, but other than an actual like physiological response to an active intervention, right? Mm. So actually some changing your biology, everything else is placebo effects. So it's lots of things.
Mm-hmm.
It's things like regression to the mean, meaning that you take a pill whenever you're at your most sick state. Well, where are you going to go from there? You can only get better, by definition.
Or
you know? Die. Yeah, if you have like a variable chronic illness where you have good days and bad days, you take a treatment on a bad day, the good day is going to follow eventually.
Right.
So that creates the illusion that the treatment works.
Mm-hmm.
There's also just just hope, and the hope of being treated makes you feel better, and then maybe emotional state dramatically affects your perception and memory of your pain,
mm-hmm.
so that will make you feel better.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's sort of what we call the non-specific therapeutic effects, meaning just being in a doctor's office and paying attention to your health is going to have some indirect health effects. You're going to maybe take better care of yourself in other ways, maybe be more compliant with your medication, all those kind of things. So just being in a clinical trial makes you better.
Mm-hmm.
That, in all these non-specific ways, those get measured as placebo effects.
Mm-hmm.
But when you ask people what's a placebo effect, they'll say it's mind over matter. It's your belief in the treatment actually healing you, and that's actually not what it is.
Right.
If there is any of that effect, no one's been able to really measure it in any significant way. The placebo effects all seem to be subjective and transient, not a real biological effect.
Well, and you mentioned that it tends to be more effective for pain because pain is all mental.
Pain's all subjective anyways. Yeah. It's what you're experiencing. And what's interesting that people don't realize there's really two components to pain, and this is true not just psychologically but neurologically. There's actually two different pain pathways, different parts of your brain processing the information. There's just, like, where in my body is the pain coming from and, you know, what does the pain feel like? Mm-hmm. And then there's the emotional component of pain. Because think about this. This is kind of mind-blowing. Why does pain hurt? Why does it hurt? There's nothing inherent about the sensation that is negative. It hurts because your brain tells you that it hurts. Because it goes into that part of your brain that assigns a negative emotional response to it.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, in fact, drugs that can cut off that component of pain. That's how narcotics actually primarily work. They work in the brain. So you could actually get to a certain dose with patients of narcotics where they still feel the pain, but it just doesn't bother them. It's not painful.
Interesting.
They have, yep, my leg hurts just as much, but it just doesn't bother me anymore. There's no emotional connection to the pain. It's all just stuff happening in your brain. And when you also think about it evolutionarily and just, you know, adaptationally, what's the purpose of pain? It's to affect your behavior.
Mm.
But there's a lot of context for pain. So what if you're being chased by the tiger? That's like the classic evolutionary example. You're always being chased by a tiger. There's always a tiger in there somewhere, right? So, okay, if you have pain when you're being chased by a tiger, it's more important for you to get away from the tiger than to attend to the pain. So you got to suppress the pain during those kind of situations. So just as one example, the pain, there's a context to pain.
Mm-hmm.
And so, sure, there's all kinds of ways to modify at multiple different levels your experience of the pain. It's all built into the system because that's what pain is all about, affecting your behavior for the given context. And so, yeah, so that's the most amenable thing to placebo effects, because it's really just exploiting all of the inherent, you know, systems that are there to manipulate how much the pain's bothering you.
Mm-hmm.
So, because that's what it's for, to bother you and affect your behavior.
That's really, really interesting and
mind-blowing.
So in my experience, I have a lot of friends who are not religious, who aren't into war, things like that, but for some reason, medicine seems to be the one thing that they will be fooled by. Like, my coworker she was getting sick and she got airborne. And I was like, you know, that doesn't do anything, right? She's like, I know, but it makes me feel better. And she was complaining about how expensive it was. And I was like, well, it's really expensive because it's nothing.
Yeah, right? It's vitamins.
It's vitamins.
It's vitamins,
yeah.
But, I mean, it certainly isn't going to heal her in the way that she thinks it's
There's
going
nothing.
To. So what is it about, even though, like, objectively people say, like, I know XYZ doesn't work, but this makes me feel better.
Why do people play the lottery when they know they're not going to win?
Right.
It's, you know, there are times when people focus on the potential for the good outcome, you know. And other times people tend to be risk averse, and psychologists are spending a lot of time trying to figure that out. Like, when are people risk averse and when do they go for the false hope?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have any way of encapsulating all that, but in medicine people do both. They sort of avoid things that probably they don't need to avoid, like the vaccines and autism.
Right.
It's really easy to scare people about certain things, and they don't want to do anything that will directly harm them. But then if you hold out the possibility of hope to them, they'll take it. Especially if they think there's no harm. So that's the old, what's the harm? It might help. You can get people to do anything if you convince them of those two things. Right? Because it kind of makes rational sense in a way. But the thing, like, with airborne is, like, well, it's not harmless. You're wasting money. You're wasting time and attention and resources. Mm-hmm. And actually, if you take it as directed, you're overdosing on vitamin A. So you can't assume there isn't even any no harm to it.
Oh.
They actually have, I don't know if they've changed it recently, but last time we looked at it, the actual recommended dose would actually overdose you on vitamin A. So it's not, we can't assume these things are harmless. But, you know, it's also, this is sophisticated. I mean, you need a medical education to really, really understand this. So they're exploiting scientific illiteracy or just being not an expert and desperation, and everyone wants to live forever. So it's really easy targets. Yeah.
And not to pile on airborne, but it might have been in your panel, they're talking about their big sell is created by a second grade teacher.
Yeah.
And for some reason that's better than created by a doctor.
Yeah.
Understands medicine and your body. And what is it about people who that's a benefit to them? Like, oh, the second grade teacher created it. That's for me.
Well, this is the everyman effect. It's like they feel like they can relate to it because, see, it's not some doctor. See, this was created by someone like me, who's just a regular average Joe. And or, well, this person is around children all the time. Kids have big germs. Then obviously this is... That must work because of that.
Yeah, it's kind of a false argument from authority. You know, they're referring to some authority, but it's not really an appropriate one.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why the school teacher, why that resonates with people. Maybe that we're all still are indoctrinated as kids to respect teachers as authorities, and it's harkening back to that, you know. So I don't know, but it's obviously worked. It's good marketing.
Yeah, okay. I'm not sure I'd... completely blanked on the question that I was going to ask you guys. So I'm nailing this.
I really like barbecue.
It's what editing and post-production.
Fix and post.
Yeah, it's
great. So what was the subject of your talk that you gave?
My talk had two purposes. It was, one was to just help patients communicate with physicians by understanding how we think a little bit better. Mm-hmm. And the other part was to highlight some critical thinking rules and show how it applies to in a medical context, but it also applies in your everyday life as well. So, you know, I talked about the fact that people often assume, it's what I call the Dr. House syndrome, that if you are ill, that there's two things that are going to happen. Either you get a diagnosis and you get better, or you don't get a diagnosis and you don't get better.
Mm-hmm.
So people become obsessed with getting the diagnosis. Now, sure, there's lots of times when that does happen. Those are two pathways that can happen. But they're not the only two.
Mm-hmm.
But because people think they're the only two, they focus way too much on just continually getting the million-dollar workup and seeing more experts and more experts until they get their magic diagnosis, then they'll be better.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, sometimes... it's okay not to have a diagnosis. Sometimes the other pathway of we've ruled everything out, we know there's nothing horrible wrong, now we could focus on your quality of life and your symptoms and your lifestyle and the stuff that we can do something about. That's okay. Mm-hmm. That's a perfectly reasonable pathway, and you want to be there because you don't want to have the horrible things that we're ruling out just to have a label for it.
Right.
Sometimes not knowing is better than knowing and something horrible. Mm-hmm. But it's amazing how that doesn't sit well with people. The not knowing bothers them more. You know, of course, that would immediately flip if they got diagnosed with a brain tumor, but that's not what they're... But before that happens, they're thinking this: the not knowing is just horrible.
Yeah.
And they're suffering, and they're just desperate for the path out, and they think that's the path out. So...
there's also hoping that they're just hoping that it's going to be something much curable, and lesser than a brain tumor.
Yeah, but again, that's also... they're kind of compartmentalizing, I think, too. They're thinking, what's the pathway of me getting better? A curable diagnosis that gets cured.
Right.
So the lack of a diagnosis becomes really upsetting to them. But there's also the diagnosis that's not curable. You ruling that out's really good. And then there's no diagnosis, or there's because we can't find any pathology.
Mm.
So, but we'll just treat your symptoms. And I think people have been indoctrinated against that, as if it's like there's something wrong with that, but it's fine. And so that's actually a pretty good pathway to be in.
And then indoctrination you just kind of talked of, do you think literally like shows like Dr. House, these kind of medical shows, are pointing people in the wrong direction?
Well, I mean, because every show is the same narrative.
Right.
You know, and that narrative is person is getting worse, nobody can make the diagnosis, Dr. House makes the magical diagnosis and then cures a patient.
It's never lupus.
That's right.
Except for that one time it was lupus.
So the other thing that they get wrong is they take a very linear approach to it because you need that for the storytelling. Mm-hmm. In reality, we just test everything up front, you know. So it doesn't really I've watched episodes where it's like, you know, like he thinks this is the diagnosis, so let's like test just for this hypothesis, which of course is not what you're supposed to do, or let's treat based upon this working diagnosis rather than a differential diagnosis where, all right, these are the most likely things, but these are the progressively less likely things, and this is all the things we're going to test for. You kind of do that up front. But, of course, then it's a one-act play, not a three-act play. But so they sacrifice any kind of real understanding of how clinical decision-making works for the narrative that works in a drama. But, unfortunately, then people walk away thinking this is how medicine works.
Right.
And part of my talk was to try to show them that that's not the case. Yeah.
Well, and it's been a double-edged sword, hasn't it, with the advent of the internet? I'm not sure if you're familiar.
No, I've heard of it, yeah.
Yeah, it's passing fad. So now everybody has all of these, you know, has access to, ostensibly, all of the answers.
Yeah, it's all there.
And WebMD and all of that. And so, in theory, it's good. Like, people have more information. But how does that... I mean, I'm sure that's tricky on you guys when they come in and say... well, I did my research, and I know that XYZ means I have lupus, so let's do that.
Yeah. Yeah, that absolutely. So sometimes it's good. Sometimes patients come in already with a lot of very focused questions, mm-hmm. and they've already done a lot of good and helpful background research mm-hmm. if they've gone to good sites, you know? Then sometimes at the other end of the spectrum, they come in with a stack of papers and a diagnosis, and they want me to just enact their diagnosis, or they are significantly kibitzing. And then I have to spend time undoing all the misinformation that they've been crammed right. with. So then it becomes counterproductive. Mm-hmm. So, and there's everything in between. So, but, you know, I don't know how you can get the good without the bad.
Yeah.
You know, it's just you want to educate the public about how to find reliable sources of information on the internet. Mm-hmm. Usually, like for shits and giggles, I'll look up medical terms on Google, and usually the first page or two are filled with nonsense.
Yeah.
You know, usually. And maybe in there will be like a science-based medicine article. I'm always happy about that. Although I understand that my own searches get contaminated by my own... You know what I mean?
Yeah,
that
yeah,
follows
yeah.
my profile, so I'd have to go to a clean computer to mm-hmm. really know what other people will find. But anyway, and then sometimes there are like academic sites which are more reliable, and that's been studied. They're actually they are more reliable,
mm-hmm.
Like WebMD you mentioned. But there might be like the University of whatever their department put a page together on this mm-hmm. disease that they treat, and usually the information there is good, except when you get to controversial stuff, and then it kind of falls off the rails.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to. It's hard, you know. It's hard. We actually give like a whole seminar on science-based medicine on just how to find good information on the internet because
yeah.
it's tricky.
Yeah.
And it's a skill set that people really need to develop. It's a life skill now. You know,
right.
getting good information off the internet is a life skill.
Mm-hmm. Huh. And isn't there a logical fallacy that I don't know the name of that is when you find the first information you find, you kind of cling to, even if you find new information? So if I went online on WebMD and I'm like, I'm sure it's this, even though you, my doctor, are
yeah.
saying, no, it's this, I'm clinging to...
Yeah, you kind of, you're biased towards the first thing that you find.
Right.
Yeah, from the first belief. Once you settle on a belief, you absolutely then nest there and
uh-huh.
defend it. So, and you become biased towards that, your whatever decisions you've already made.
Right.
Like you're just justifying your beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we just hit a half hour. So, quickly, how can people follow you or get a hold of both of you, if need be? John?
I'm on Twitter at CardJohn, CardJohn.
Mm-hmm.
So at CardJohn, you can call me there.
Okay.
Just go to theskepticsguide.org. You can get to our social media empire through that portal.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you both so much for joining me. And thank you. You can find Friendly Atheist at friendlyatheist.com. And thank you so much for coming by.
Thanks for listening to the podcast for friendlyatheist.com.
Our theme song was written and performed by Brad Chagdis, and thanks to Michael Greif for helping us with on-site recording.
If you like what you're hearing, please consider making a contribution at patreon.com/Hemant. That's He-Man T. We appreciate your support. I'm Hemant Mehta.
And I'm Jessica Blumke.
We hope you join us next time.